What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. I'm Larry Rifkin, and John Krofcik still remains John Krofcik.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Or good evening. Or good morning. Whenever you're listening to this.
Yes.
We want to make certain we're where our audience is, John.
That's right.
Have you ever read the book, The Seven Habits of, Successful People? What is that? Stephen Covey book.
I have never read that. That sounds like something my wife would read, but I have never read it. What are the seven habits?
I never would have guessed that you hadn't read it, John, given your illustrious career. I don't know what they are. I mean, it's like, you know,
have
the
you
seven
read it?
Sins. No, I haven't read it either. No, I think I did years ago.
Did you? Okay.
And I used to do those
habits. I got a lot of habits that I got
that you have to break? Well, I've got to tell you that I remember years ago on my radio program, I had a guy who was into the self-help actualization movement.
Ah, yes.
But you know,
you had a lot of those people.
I know, I did. But you know what the acronym is? Self-help actualization movement. What does that stand for? Sham.
Oh, gotcha.
And what's amazing is that he would say, this gentleman who wrote the book, saying that the whole self-help actualization movement was a sham. And what he would say was that people who get one self-help book generally get many others because they think the secret sauce of life is going to be included in one of those books. And they keep looking, searching, lurching, trying to find the answers.
Well, I guess we're all searching. What are the answers?
I've stopped.
Why are we
searching?
Here?
I'm just.
What is the meaning of life?
What is the meaning? Why?
Why?
No, but I bring this up because a gentleman that we are going to be talking to in just a moment is involved with something that I know is not part of any self-help actualization movement or the seven traits of successful people. I know that. But I find it so interesting. He is saying that if we are really going to be successful as a political culture here in America, you know what we need a little bit more of?
Oof, tell me.
Well, I guess we could use a little bit more knowledge because I think a lot of people don't know when they go into the voting booth what it is that they're really voting for.
Well,
they really have such a scant sense of the information that is necessary to make an informed judgment. If you recall, John, another thing I did on the radio program was tell people that, you know, they spent a lot of time and we just did the big series on vacations and travel. And by the way, all of the stuff that we talk about that we've already done remains available to you.
It sure does.
At AmericaTrendsPodcast.com. So just because we're talking about it in the past tense doesn't mean it can't be in your future.
No, you're
absolutely
right.
So don't forget about that.
It's all up there to be had.
But we talked about travel and we can talk about travel again, but a lot of people really spend a lot of time thinking about their vacations, planning their vacations, and actually trying to finance their vacations instead of focusing on their retirements or how they're going to pay for college. I mean, there are so many people who just have everything kind of backward. And so when we go into a voting booth, I was saying that if you don't have enough time to think about who you're going to be voting for, then give that responsibility to me, and I'll give you a printout that explains exactly who you voted for and why you voted for them. You'll sound so informed and so knowledgeable that people will be amazed to hear that you had a real rationale rather than, well, I kind of liked him. He seemed to be good. You know, that kind of thing.
He's a nice looking person.
Yeah, he was nice looking. He had good hair.
Good hair.
He had good hair.
I think my mother used that one.
Well, I think a lot of people have voted based on hair. Well, let's take a look at that. But Michael Patrick Lynch, who we're going to be speaking to in a moment, he has a really interesting concept that we in America, if we're going to succeed, we are really going to need to demonstrate more humility. Humility. Now, have you really ever heard that in the context of public dialogue?
Not at all, no.
And this isn't a period for shrinking violets. When you look at a Donald Trump, you know this is not a period where there's a lot of humility going around, would you say?
No, that's for sure.
Well, you know, it's interesting the way he describes it. And I'm not going to get into the entire argument, but he's saying that we all in America, if we're going to have any meaningful political discourse and not come apart in the way that we're coming apart now, we really do need to have humility. And the humility that he's talking about is an understanding that what somebody else has to say is worthy of my time and consideration, and not to rule it out. Oh, she's a conservative. I'm not going to listen to her. Oh, that's a liberal. I'm not going to listen to them. And that we need a little more humility about what it is that we think so that we can take in what other people think.
Well, I agree with you, but then I disagree with you because I have a problem with the Republicans and the Democrats and everybody else, the quality of candidates we get. So our choices are limited right there, right from the start.
You know, I've always gone outside of the two-party system, John. So you're talking, you're barking up the wrong tree.
We need somehow to get a grassroots effort to get better better people, more knowledgeable people we've talked to run for these offices that really know what's going on.
And people who don't fit into any one box.
Right.
Or haven't limited their thinking simply because they have group think. And if I'm not down the road left or down the road right, then I have no place to be or to go. I've always had a unique package of beliefs that I think make sense to me. Now, there are a lot of people out there today, I'm reading, who are moderate in terms of their social views about let live and so forth, and right, much more conservative when it comes to fiscal matters.
Right. I think a lot of people are like
many.
That. I think,
but
I
where
think
is that reflected?
Once you start working and you see how much the government takes out of your paycheck, you become a conservative, I think.
On that score.
It becomes realistic to you. You know, it's in your hands.
But, you know, as we also begin to live in a much more diverse society, we begin to be more accepting of different things that perhaps when we were growing up, we never would have imagined.
There
are a lot of people who just don't fit into a box. But what Michael Patrick Lynch is telling us is that intellectual humility, seeing our worldview as open to improvement by the evidence and experience of other people. And I think that's a wonderful thing to keep in mind. And he's got a course at my old alma mater, and I'm very proud of that. He teaches at the University of Connecticut, and he's got an entire, what should we call it there? It's a program. He's the head of humanities at UConn, and he's also leading UConn's humility and conviction in public life project.
Wow.
Now, conviction in Connecticut with politicians has another connotation. A lot of them have been convicted. But we're talking here about having conviction about really having meaningful dialogue in the public square. And I'll tell you, he's worth listening to. And I really got interested in him by watching a TED Talk.
Yeah.
Have you watched any of these TED Talks?
You know, I haven't. I know I have them on my Roku, but I haven't had a chance. I got to go up to the TED and watch it.
Now, you're not thinking of the movie TED.
No.
No, that character, no.
No, I know the TED Talks.
No, the TED Talks.
There's
really
a TED Talks channel on my Roku.
Okay, so you got to go on. No, but you did look at a TED Talk, I believe. That doctor that we had on said he's going to do the head transplant.
Yes.
Yeah, we had a doctor on. We should get him on again.
We should.
Dr. Carnavara. Remember him?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, keep your head about you while others
are
losing
theirs.
Where
were we, from Italy or something?
We got him from Italy. John was persistent, but he swears that by the end of 2017, he is going to be doing a full head transplant with 117 doctors. Well, I've got to tell you, I think we got a little off track.
I think we did, but I think we got to get back. This sounds like a very interesting course this guy is teaching, and hopefully it'll give college students a chance to really look at both sides of the issue and look at the people who they're electing instead of the CNN side.
CNN. So. Well, I'll tell you what. Michael Patrick Lynch, a very serious guy, very interesting guy. And he is going to talk to us about needing to find a common reality if we're going to start moving forward and get out of our intellectual bubbles and our inability really to listen to other people. It's really an appropriate topic at this time in our public life. Let's take a listen.
Let's get him on.
Michael Patrick Lynch is the director of the humanities at the University of Connecticut, and he's leading UConn's Humility and Conviction in Public Life project. He's also the author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. And Michael, thank you so much for being with us today. And I do want to ask about this UConn Humility and Conviction in Public Life project. I know I went to UConn many years ago, and we didn't have anything like that at the time. Tell us what this is.
Sure. And, well, Larry, let me just say thanks for having me on. I'm pleased to be here. So the research project is a project that's funded by both a grant from the John Templeton Foundation, a $6 million grant, and a significant grant from UConn as well. And the basic idea of the project is to take and apply research, produce new research, and apply that research in a very engaged, on-the-ground sort of way to help figure out how to renew our fractured public discourse in this country. And the name, Humility and Conviction, comes from this thought, paradoxical thought and problem that's facing us right now. Right now, I think we'd all agree that democracies don't function if their citizens don't have some conviction. An apathetic electorate is no electorate at all. On the other hand, we also think that democracies can't really function if the citizens aren't willing to listen to each other's conviction. And more than just listen, actually be willing to perhaps learn and realize that somebody who has a different sort of viewpoint might be able to teach you something, and that other people can bring something to the table that, that you can use and help your own worldview improve. But of course, we both know that these sort of these conviction and humility, those are in tension. Often, the people who are willing to sort of listen to others are regarded with suspicion from those who believe take themselves to be the true believers. And often, the people who have the strongest convictions are not willing to sort of treat others and themselves with a sense of humility. So, what we're trying to do is to figure out how to balance those two democratic values, and we think that that's a path in and an original path in to thinking about how to renew meaningful public discourse.
I'm wondering how students at UConn are accepting the charge to be more humble and admit that perhaps we don't know all. Are they? Because everybody's in an information bubble, and I know in the TED Talk that you did recently on common reality, you talked about these information bubbles and how they really disrupt our ability to be humble and to be allowing and to let in other people's views.
Yes, polarization is clearly a significant problem that we're facing right now. You know, human beings have always been polarized and divided over values, and indeed some disagreement over values is to be expected and healthy in a democracy. When it gets more troubling is when we become divided not just over values, but over facts. And more than that, sometimes when we get divided over our ways of determining what a fact is and our sources and which sources are reliable. Once we become so polarized as to not to agree on any of those things, not to have any sort of common standards for what counts as rational or not, it's very difficult to figure out how to move on from there and engage in sort of reasoned public debate. I think what's happening right now is this knowledge polarization, that's what I call it, this type of polarization, is being, you know, it wasn't created by the Internet, but the Internet has sped it up. It's making it worse in a certain way simply because our life online is very personalized, and everything we read from the ads that go across our pages that we look at on the internet to the news that comes down our Facebook feed is going to be tailored to satisfy our preferences. And as a result, it has a tendency to inflate our bubbles rather than bursting them.
Yes, you point out that this digital self-selection, we might say that it's a technological situation, but really, if we look at it, it's a human problem. We want to wall ourselves off. And I know that some of these services are trying to figure out ways not to allow us to be that distant from others and be as disagreeable as we seem to be online. But it really is a human problem when you get to the root of it.
I think that's exactly right. Human beings have a natural tendency to engage or fall into what psychologists now call confirmation bias, which is really just a fancy way of labeling the familiar experience that people have, if they're honest with themselves, of just going along with opinions that already fit their preconceived view. Right? We find it easier to just accept things that already match what we tend to believe. And as a result, it's very hard for us to deal with incoming evidence that might be contrary to what we believe. So that's a sort of natural phenomenon that human beings are sort of hardwired or to fall victim to. So in order to sort of confront these problems, we're going to need help from psychology. And one of the things we're doing in this project that I was mentioning is we're working with 10 different teams of researchers around the world, some of them psychologists, some of them political scientists, some of them philosophers, some of them historians, some of them theologians, many of these teams comprising people who come from all these specialties, to try to address some of these psychological problems and understand, for example, in one case, some researchers were working with at Brown, to figure out what the brain looks like really when on dogma, as it were. What dogma does to the brain?
That.
Yeah, you know what drugs do to the brain and what dogma does to the brain, and it fries it just like drugs, I think. Getting back to the point, the human problem that exists here extends just beyond, I think, just the psychological. Doing the psychological research and the sort of political science research we're doing along with it is absolutely crucial. But we also have to realize that there are certain fundamental values that we need to reconnect with. And that's where my work and the work of my other colleagues in philosophy come in. Because it's in thinking about what matters that will allow us to sort of get clearer on what meaningful public discourse really should be and how far away from it we are right now.
And, of course, there are so many people who say, wait a minute, you know, I live in my part of the world. You live in your part of the world. I'm in a rural environment. You're in an urban environment. Our values are very different. You say, though, that we need to turn to philosophy to reestablish a key concept that we live in a common reality. And yet there's so many people who say, no, my reality and my life is so different, I can't relate to you or to yours.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's one of the fundamental values that I'm most concerned about, this idea that we live in a common reality. The funny thing about that is it's one of those ideas when you say it out loud, you think, well, of course, right? Of course I live, there's a common reality out there that we all have to deal with. But like a lot of really important values and concepts, we can sometimes overlook them and realize and forget really how important they are. And sometimes our value can be drained away merely because we're overlooking them. And I think that's the case with common reality right now. And on top of that is the point that you just mentioned, which is that we also are facing pressure because of the polarization that we're engaging in to just stop valuing it overtly, you know, to actually just, as you said, there is pressure to think, well, look, I don't really have anything in common with people on the right, or if somebody's on the right saying that I don't have anything much in common with the people on the left. But that's a really big mistake because, in fact, we do have a lot of things in common. One thing we have in common, for example, is that we live on the same planet, and we need to accept that. There's another pressure here, too, which is that people who are becoming cynical about the idea of sharing common ground and living in the same reality are being led to that by a sort of type of cynicism about the possibility of truth. I mean, after all, if you don't really think that there is any such thing as objective truth, or you think that doesn't matter, then you're not going to be particularly concerned with whether there's a common reality that we're getting right or wrong. And because of the polarization that we were talking about before, a lot of people, I think, can throw their hands up in the air and say, well, as one political commentator put it not long ago, well, there really aren't any facts anymore. But that is a mistake. It's a mistake to think that there are no such things as facts. What's true is that it's really hard to know what the facts are. It's really hard to know exactly what the common ground is in many cases. But the fact that it's hard to know shouldn't convince us that there is no truth and that there isn't some commonalities that we can share in common.
I love the fact that you so simply describe what fake news is, in your view. It simply means a news story that I don't like, that somehow is bad faith toward the truth that I believe. And so right. That's how you discount what it is that you're reading or listening to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that people, you know, the term fake news came about not too long ago, really, in common parlance as a way of, originally, of labeling deliberately misleading, you know, false, made up fake news stories that were created to look like news stories, but in fact were completely fabricated out of whole cloth. But very quickly, and very, very quickly, because of the knowledge polarization that exists right now, people started to use the term and appropriate the term to label it, as you said, for anything that they didn't like. And that indicates, I think, an unfortunate tendency we're falling into right now, which is what I call bad faith towards the truth. One way of thinking about what that means is, remember in the movie The Matrix, the main character wakes up to realize that he's been living in an illusion, that actually reality is very different than what he thought. He thought it was like much like our reality, but it really turns out that the machines have taken over and caused all the humans to have this shared illusion. And one of the things that happens in that movie is that one of the characters, not a particularly great character, realizes he's not a good guy. He realizes that he's living in the Matrix too, but he decides he just likes it better that way. He prefers illusion to reality because, as he puts it once memorably in the movie, the steak, all the wine. I know it's fake, but it still tastes good. I think that's the position that many of us are falling into right now with regard to our information bubbles. It's just easier to wrap ourselves in our cozy information bubbles and label the other side fake news and take our created reality, curated information bubble, as the measure of all things. But that's bad faith. That's like saying that I'd rather just live in the Matrix. And that is a very dangerous thing.
Well, you do point out the dangers. And, I mean, the dangers are despotism. Take us from where we are today in terms of this skepticism, this inability to wrap ourselves around any common reality, and take it all the way to despotism. How does it get there?
Well, I think it gets there because cynicism about truth begins with the idea, as I said, that, well, really, objective truth is impossible to get to. We'll never be able to step outside of our bubbles, as we say. And that seems like a comforting thought. We think we've sort of like, well, we're cynical. We've realized that we'll never be able to see the objective truth. And we say, well, then the objective truth doesn't matter. The ancient Greek philosopher Pythagoras put that by saying, man is the measure of all things. But the problem with that thought and the way it leads to despotism is like this. It's very simple. The idea that man is the measure of all things inevitably becomes the man is the measure of all things. Because if once you give up on the idea that there's a common world out there to which we have to be responsible, to which our thoughts can either get right or get wrong, once you give it up on that idea, then really whatever passes for truth in our bubble is going to be what's true. But, of course, what passes for truth in our bubble is going to be often determined by forces outside, then forces and power, as Foucault pointed out a long time ago. So let me illustrate that, though, in a slightly more or less highfalutin way. Mm-hmm. by referring to George Orwell's novel, and particularly the end of the novel that you're...
All right, we're talking about 1984.
Remember. And I'm talking about 1984, yes. Thank you. So at the end of the novel, the thought policeman O'Brien is torturing the protagonist, whose name is Winston Smith, into believing 2 plus 2 equals 5. And the point O'Brien makes very clear is to get Smith to believe that everything the party says is the truth, and the truth is whatever the party says. And what O'Brien knows is that once people begin to accept that thought, that the truth is whatever the power says is true, then critical dissent, critical thought itself becomes almost impossible. Because once you accept that the power speaks the truth, then you cannot, by definition, speak truth to power. So that's how it leads to despotism. It undermines the ability for us to point to something objective and say, look, no matter what you're saying, no matter what the people in power might be saying are true, no matter what is passing for true within our bubble, that's actually not right. It's actually getting things objectively wrong. And that's what we mean by speaking truth to power.
How have we gotten to a point where this notion of truth and the ability to discern what it is and to agree on it almost universally is so difficult?
Well, I think that's where our discussion of knowledge polarization definitely plays a part. There's another aspect of this, too, that relates to our use of technology, and that is that much of our ways of knowing nowadays are often very passive. That's been true for a long time, of course. People tend to prefer sort of passive, spoon-fed bits of knowledge. But our technology now has gotten really, really good at giving us that sort of knowledge. Much of what we know now, we Google now. We download pre-packaged sets of facts and pass them along the assembly line of social media. And that's incredibly useful because we don't have to memorize all sorts of things. We can just sort of download facts when we need them. But that sort of way of knowing also has a downside. And that downside is that it really involves a sort of cognitive outsourcing. We're sort of outsourcing our intellectual labor when we know in that way. And although, as I just pointed out, that's incredibly useful, and it's the sort of thing that we do as well when we listen to an expert or look something up in the encyclopedia, the prevalence of it right now, our ability to know almost everything in this particular Google knowing sort of way, is, I think, blunting some of our ability to engage in more active ways of learning and knowing.
And by the way, I love the way in your TED Talk, and I'd love to hear you expound on this, you talk about the fact that maybe researching something on your own or trying to find a proof for it by experimenting with social concepts or whether they're physical concepts or whatever they may be. And then I loved when you said, or just talking to someone else.
Yes,
and exactly. Debating it.
Right.
My goodness.
Talking, I know, right? I know.
I love
it's
that.
Radical, isn't it? talking to somebody, you know? I know. We're talking revolution here. We're talking revolution. I mean, it is sort of funny that we're at a state, right, where that is sort of that we have to say that. That we're even, you know, we become, and I include myself in this, right? I'm a, you know, I carry my smartphone around everywhere I go. I feel dumb when I don't have it with me. Suddenly I don't seem to have all the information of the world at my fingertips. In fact, I don't when I don't have it with me. But it's let our sort of incredibly rapid way in which we have come to be dependent on this way of knowing has led us, I think, to a state where, for example, saying that, you know, it's worth saying out loud that, you know, folks, sometimes it really helps to get outside and experience things. And talk to people and look up from your phone and talk to engage somebody in conversation and see whether you can find some common ground with them.
Well, you
so you're asking
do.
Your,
explain to us that too often this passive Googling just kind of reinforces what it is that we're thinking, means that we're going to the sources that just confirm, as you say, our bias. So there we are. We're always right. And we feel very comforted in knowing that we're right. And you said daring to find out more means the possibility exists and the risk that we'll find that we're wrong.
Exactly. When earlier you had asked me, how do we get to this point? As I said, one of the things, ways that we've got here to the cynical point is because through knowledge polarization. But really that plays into this Google knowing. The two connect because Google knowing too often becomes bubble knowing. That is just, you know, knowing conditioned by your bubble or believing conditioned by your bubble. And the problem with that is that it too often leads to the idea that you're always right. And Kant, a long time ago, said that the motto of the Enlightenment was that Enlightenment meant, as he put it, daring to know for yourself. And daring to know for yourself means, and daring, that's the important word here, daring to know means taking the risk that you could be wrong, trying to figure something out, trying to go uncover the evidence, forming a belief, and then realizing that, well, more evidence might come down the pike that contradicts that. So you're taking a risk of being wrong. And too often right now, we're living in a constructed bubble world where we are not taking that risk, where too much of the information we're receiving is personalized and tailored to just get us news that we already are structured to and biased to believe. So I think that combination of forces, this sort of combination of our human beings being subject to confirmation bias, of the technology and the knowledge polarization that's existing right now, this becomes a toxic mix that leads to what I think of as a culture of arrogance, and a particular type of arrogance. Arrogance, what we might call epistemic or intellectual arrogance, the sort of sense that we know it all. Know-it-allism has become a major symptom, I think, of our cultural malaise. And I think it's not surprising. I mean, whatever you think of Donald Trump's policies, I think almost everyone would agree that his attitude conveys that type of arrogance, the sense that he alone can fix things. He knows what is right. And again, even if you agree with his policies, that attitude is certainly one that I think most people would associate, right, whether on right or left.
Yeah, and you tell us that arrogance is a lot easier having it all figured out, but it's bad faith when it comes to really wanting to uncover the truth. And I want to get back to the issue of humility. We're talking, by the way, to Michael Patrick Lynch, and he is the director of the humanities at the University of Connecticut and is leading UConn's Humility and Conviction in Public Life project. He's also the author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. You say that we need to have humility, knowing that we don't know it all. So what kind of humility is involved in that process?
Well, I think the type of humility here is that I'm thinking about is a specific kind, and it's sort of the opposite of the arrogance, that type of arrogance I was talking about. We might call it intellectual or epistemic humility. And what it means is, or what I think it means, this is what I mean by it, is a willingness to see your own worldview as being open to improvement by the evidence and experience of other people. That's more than just being open to change. It's good to be open to change most of the time, unless you're changing in the wrong direction. it's also more than just being open to self-improvement. A lot of people are, you know, self-improvement is great. But what I'm talking about is the attitude of taking an attitude towards yourself and others, that towards your own worldview, that it can improve by what other people, by virtue of what other people might bring to the table. That is, that you can learn something from those who have different experiences than your own. That attitude is what I call this attitude of epistemic or intellectual humility. And I don't think it would be a surprise to any of us here in this conversation to say that our culture has not been particularly great at encouraging citizens to have this sort of attitude.
And you remind us that this is very dangerous because a democracy has a very difficult time functioning if we don't inhabit some common space and if we don't believe that there is some truth and have the humility to know that we are not the sum of all reality.
Yeah, that's right. And so, and this brings us back to the theme on which we started, that is the project that we're pursuing here at UConn. Democracies, you're right, can't function or function as well as they should if they don't strive and if their citizens don't strive to inhabit a common space, a space in which we can exchange reasons and ideas even when and especially when we disagree. Because if we're not trying to solve our problems by exchanging reasons and ideas, we'll find other possibly violent ways to resolve our problems. The history of humankind is littered with examples of that fact. And so it is dangerous that we are losing or not encouraging enough this attitude towards ourselves. And we all have a responsibility to try to encourage this attitude in ourselves, in our children, and in our institutions, because our democratic institutions can work to encourage this attitude of humility, but they can also work to, if we're not careful, to encourage arrogance. And I think that if we really want to embrace a truly functioning democracy, we have to start with the simple basics, philosophical basics. And that includes encouraging the attitude of humility, encouraging people to believe that there's objective truth is possible, and embracing the idea that we do, in fact, live in a common reality.
When you live in a system that has only two parties, and it has worked in the past when we've all congealed somewhere around the center, but now if those who are active in our politics and as opinion leaders are as fragmented on the left and the right as they are, how do we ever get back to that common center, if you will?
Well, I think getting back to the common center is, if we can mean two things by that. I think getting back to a certain sense of common ground, realizing that we do have common ground, we can disagree, but that there is some common principles that we share in common, that, I think, is absolutely crucial. Getting back to the sense of, that I think is a little bit different than just the idea that we're, let's say, agreeing on, let's say, something that's in between the left and the right, mm-hmm. per se. Mm-hmm. Because it may be that, that our common principles at the end of the day will suggest that one particular view embraced on the right but not on the left, or on the left and not on the right, is the right way to pursue, and the moderate path isn't. Nonetheless, how do we get back to this set of common principles that I was talking about? Well, I think it's simple. In another way, it's incredibly complicated. The simple bit is to realize what it is that what sort of values we need to propagate in order to at least be open to the thought that there are these common principles. And those are the ones I listed: the idea of active learning, of believing in truth, and having, encouraging this attitude of humility. The hard bit, of course, is figuring out how to do that institutionally and in our educational system. And that's where our research projects that we're pursuing are, that's what they're aimed at doing, is trying to figure out what the mechanisms are by which we in our educational system and in our psychology can actually achieve and realize these values that I mentioned.
If people want to know more about your project at UConn, how can they find more information? And you can certainly let us know about your TED Talks and the like, too.
So I'd urge people to Google, because after all, as we talked about, Googling is how we know things nowadays. So what else am I going to suggest? I'm not going to suggest look it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica. So Google, go ahead and Google Humility and Conviction in Public Life. You'll find our website, helpfully called Humility and Conviction in Public Life, at UConn.edu. And I encourage people to join our mailing list, and you can find out information about all the projects that we are pursuing at UConn. And also, as far as the TED Talk, that could be found at TED.com. And the book is available at Amazon and booksellers everywhere.
Okay. Michael Patrick Lynch. And again, a lot of what we've been talking about today is featured in the TED Talk titled Finding Common Reality. I thank you so much for being part of America Trends podcast today, and we look forward to talking with you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some rankings, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
Nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know. But we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us.
But. Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms. And, John, this is really easy. At Trends Podcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to check it out now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that, too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using the hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? You know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more, because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste, and you get more programming like this, and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works
Absolutely.
For all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. Let us out.
What's that?
They're not going to let us out.
No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time, and we're posting on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.